Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 279, Catching Up with Max Lau. Thank you all so much for the messages of sympathy while I was ill. I hope you enjoyed some kind of break over the holiday season. I will be sitting down across a Zoom call with Anthony Caldelis soon to bring you parts 3 and 4 of our series. But today we are catching up with Max Lau. Dr. Lau came on the show 50 episodes ago to talk about his book, which covered the life and career of John Komnenos, Alexius' son, Manuel's father. Max lent me the manuscript of his book, which heavily influenced my coverage of John's career, and now the good news is the book has been published. We talk about how you can buy the book and why you might want to in the interview. And if you'd like a discount, then go to thehistoryofbyzantium.com, find the page for episode 279, and the details are all there. After talking about the book, I decided to quiz Max on everything we've been through since Manuel's reign, the collapse of the empire, and the Fourth Crusade, to see what insights he can offer and the different opinions he has on what went down. It's a wide-ranging discussion of the past 50 episodes or so. I hope you enjoy. Dr. Maximilian Lau, welcome back to the History of Byzantium.
Good to be here.
Well, I think any listeners struggling to recall will remember this was episode 229 when you were last on the show to talk about John Komnenos. You had at that time written the book on Alexius's son, Manuel's dad, and you kindly shared it with me, which greatly enriched the podcast. And we have good news because I've had messages ever since then saying, oh, well, I want to buy this book. Where's this book? When's this book coming out? And the book is now out.
Finally, yeah, I know the lag on these things takes quite a while. But yeah, no, very glad to report that it is finally out in hardback anyway, which is, yeah, also why, particularly actually for your listeners today, I've actually got a little discount count code for you all, which shouldn't run out ever. So because I realize this, partially because of all the photos and things in it, this is a bit of a pricey item. I have hope one day it might come out in paperback, but you know, no knowing on these things, that's up to the people above. This will probably hopefully go on the website as well. But for any listeners here, if you go onto the OUP website, and you know, if you go to the, you know, usual place you put in some discount codes when you sort of try and buy one of these things, and if you type in AAFLYG6, so that's AAFLYG6, that'll get you 30% off. Which hopefully should be useful for some of you on this sort of stuff, which is, yeah, the least I can do considering so these things are not cheap kind of thing. But hopefully, as I said, all the photos and everything else in there make up for it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is academic publishing, obviously.
Yeah.
And I don't think they realize that there is more of a market out there now with the internet kind of spreading Byzantine content around. So, yeah, I will put all this on the website. So the Oxford University Press have published this book. I recommend it highly. Obviously, go back to episode 229 for more on the specifics and on John. But the pictures, I think, are particularly exciting for hardcore Byzantinists, because you traveled all over Turkey and the Balkans and climbed up, you know, these great hills and mountain passes, and took photos of these crumbling forts, which obviously tour guides just don't take people to. There isn't that wider interest unless you're sort of into a podcast like this. So I loved it.
It's absolutely one of those things where, I mean, even just finding some of these things, I mean, some of these books, I mean, there is the Foss volume, which talks about, say, Byzantine forts, which came out in the 1980s. And you read this volume and there's a few sort of grainy black and white photos that, you know, he took probably in the early 70s, maybe earlier. And, you know, he says things like, oh, you know, just to the south of this town. And obviously this town is now a massive city. Where exactly is this thing? And so, you know, absolutely finding these things is a bit of an issue, to say the least. So yeah, tracking these down is fun. But equally, there's hopefully a few things on there. I mean, I have half wondered whether, I don't know, I should write some sort of, I don't know, Byzantine travel guide to this part of the world, and a few of these things, if there was any interest or something. But yeah, some of the, I mean, things like, say, Anazarbos, which is, in Cilicia, you know, so if you see the fairy chimneys and the balloons and all this kind of stuff, it's in that neck of the woods, kind of down into, you know, just say Cappadocia, that sort of area there. And, you know, there's no gift shop, there's no whatever it is. You can find that on Google Maps, just typing in, you know, Anazarbos, Kalesi. And yet you just wander all over this thing. And it is a huge ruined, you know, sort of Byzantine Armenian city just sitting there. With a kind of, you know, ancient Roman sort of, you know, high street and things down at the bottom. And then up at the top, I mean, this whole fortress, and you've got sort of, you know, Komnenian, rebuilded bits. You can see sort of quite obviously the bits which are kind of, you know, okay, those are obviously Komnenian looking. These are more, you know, sort of later sort of grand Armenian stuff. And yeah, there's no one anywhere. I mean, there's a sort of shepherd or two, maybe you can ask directions for. So yeah, go nuts, people. I mean, there's all this stuff out there.
Well, that's of course where John died as well.
Very near, yeah.
Yeah, he died
right there. Yeah,
he was staying there, waiting to take over Antioch, and it all went wrong. So, I had dreams of doing a tour that would go there on the way to Antakya, and of course the tragic earthquake has made that a long distant dream now. But I loved the book for things like that. So yeah, thoroughly recommend it. Do go check it out. All the details on the website for this episode. But of course, you have studied not just John Komnenos during your time as a Byzantine scholar. And so we were having conversations. You introduced me to Nathan Websdale, who I've had on to talk about what's happened since John and since Manuel. So I thought we'd have a little catch up and just see if you had any insights you wanted to share on the period that we've covered in the last sort of 50 episodes or so. Because obviously, one of the interesting things I thought at the end of your book was you talked about what if John hadn't died. And we sort of touched on the interview, you know, what would he have done next? And what would he have gone back to Constantinople as an older man and tried to sort out, you know, ecclesiastical issues and so on and so on. And so you would have opinions on how Manuel then handles things when he takes over. But my sense is he didn't have long to continue his father's legacy before the Second Crusade happens, which seemed to me at the time to sort of change the game. Would that be your sense of that? Or
yeah, there's a few different things here. Partially, I mean, there's the manner of how and when he took over. Because, you know, there he was, as you said, sort of, you know, in Cilicia, and suddenly there he is with the army, and in circumstances that definitely sort of are interesting, sort of, you know, is named as the next emperor, you know, Sabaksuk goes off, arrests his brother, sort of up in Constantinople. And, you know, this is not a normal way. I mean, maybe there is no normal way as such, but this is not exactly sort of, you know, and here is my son. You know, being presented in the capital, taking over, which is why, I mean, reading that early bit of Manuel's reign, you know, it seems like he has to cover lots of the same ground that John did. Because just like John, or indeed Alexius, or indeed many other emperors before and after, you immediately have to kind of reestablish yourself. And, you know, had his elder brother Alexius, you know, just naturally, you know, been there, then of course he had been doing this for the last, you know, sort of 10 years at least. And so would have kind of had any, you know, wouldn't have had to redefeat the Serbs, redefeat the Turks on the borders, all of these kind of things. I mean, that's part of it.
I should probably jump in the flow, just in case any listeners are lost. Mm. Just remind them that when John dies, his two eldest sons die within the same year, or within the same next 12 months, leaving his two younger sons, and Manuel, who is the youngest, then kind of takes the throne because he's with the army in Cilicia. So just reminding people of that context. So as you say, so then there's confusion with all these people who John had a relationship with, going, well, do I still have to stick to what I agreed, you know, and so on. Yeah. So just to remind people of that.
No, and particularly there's the, I mean, there's a couple of sort of references to the idea, because there he was with four sons until just before he died. And there are various sources that imply that he was going to, you know, give each of them little positions. I mean, there's this one particular source that implies one is going to head off to Jerusalem and one is going to head off to, you know, to Italy, to old Rome. This is written much later, and so it's possibly a bit fanciful. But this idea that, okay, each of the sons would have something useful to do and to contribute seems to have been set up quite early. And then suddenly two of them are gone, including the one who was meant to be, you know, the full emperor after him. And I mean, my theory that comes out on this is that, you know, this was still something he was wrestling with when suddenly he's dying. And then he's got one son next to him and one son off in Constantinople. And usually it's not, I mean, if you look at, say, Barbarossa, you know, sort of, you know, sort of the emperor, what happens when the emperor dies and this army just disperses and nothing useful happens? You don't want to do that kind of thing. In some ways, I mean, this is something John did right, even on his deathbed, was, you know, probably should give it to, you know, the person I'm with here, so that the whole thing doesn't completely fall apart. But I suppose picking up the old thread, I mean, you know, you can see in some ways before the Second Crusade, you know, there is an attempt to pick things up where he left off. I mean, there is the siege of Konya, Iconian, virtually immediately, which is very much one of those things that I think, I mean, with a little stepping stone approach, you know, the lake people, all these sorts of things, that is where John is aiming at. And, you know, his son picks this up and is going for this when the Second Crusade starts. And, you know, therefore, you know, there, this very, very early period there is pure continuity in some ways, even despite lots of some of the insecurity and having to retread some of these paths there. Then, this is sort of one of those, you know, to what extent is this, you know, sort of Manuel's, like, you know, personal kind of personality, I suppose, coming out here. Because then, of course, you get these sort of really, these prestige campaigns, you know, which are pretty amazing. I mean, just thinking of the sort of the logistics involved into the Egypt campaign, or indeed the Italy campaign. But then equally, all of these are grounded pretty solidly. I mean, thinking of the fact that under John, he goes Balkans and Anatolia and back within the year after year, not to mention occasionally having, you know, some armies operating in different theaters, you know, under different generals. This is one of those things that doesn't come up in the sources so much because, you know, the emperor's kind of the main character of these sources. And so when some other general's doing something somewhere else, it's usually reported on far less. But you do still have a few, you know, times of some of the Conte Stefani, you know, sort of winning something against the Serbs while John is in Anatolia. This is really logistically difficult to do in the medieval period. So as much as, you know, some sources have talked about, oh, you know, Manuel wasted his time on Italy or Egypt, some of these almost came off. I mean, it's the idea of this guy doing, I don't know, five different jigsaw puzzles at once, whereas really he should have finished one and then possibly moved on to the next one, whereas he's sort of trying for all of them. And John does this too. In some ways, this is a continuity of failures, I suppose. Whereas for a little while, John is backing, I mean, I've got a whole chapter in the book on this. He's backing a sort of a Turkish prince. He's backing a Serb prince. He's backing a Hungarian prince all at the same time. In some ways, had this somehow pulled off, you know, this would have absolutely given him, you know, all of these areas as clients. But unsurprisingly, you know, this is overstretched. And then that was when, you know, Trebizond goes into rebellion. That's when Venice decides, you know, this is our moment. So therefore, you know, reach exceeding grasp is very much something that John suffered from as well. He just, you know, managed to kind of, you know, pull up and pull out a little bit. He realized, okay, time to make the slightly humiliating peace with Venice. And then I can focus on the Balkans. Balkans is sorted. Now I can return to Anatolia, pull it all up together. But, you know, early John also has lots of the same failures of Manuel in a way. So there's a lot of continuities here. Likewise, on the kind of diplomacy side of things, I mean, with the Germans, obviously this whole, you know, marriage with, you know, Bertha Irene, this is, you know, negotiated under John, and also with Jerusalem. I mean, you know, in this late period of John, you have John's cousin Adrian, who's sort of a monk and later a bishop of Ohrid, you know, sort of going over to Jerusalem and the Holy Land, seeing everything, meeting everybody, giving, you know, giving some money out, very much the kind of soft power approach, which, you know, is, which doesn't come out in some of the other sort of books on this, but, you know, lots of the kind of soft power Manuel stuff is also going on under John. So I think there is, to be fair, a lot of continuity there, even despite sort of this, I know, portrayal of sort of Manuel as the more sort of party prince, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. So obviously Manuel's reign is long, and so we can't sort of talk about every in and out of it. I mean, my conclusion on him is that he had a more complicated time geopolitically than anyone, I think, since Justinian almost, just because the, you know, the Balkans for a long time wasn't divided between sort of four or five powers, and the East was sort of always one power. So it was a much sort of simpler dynamic for emperors for hundreds of years, whereas he's suddenly having to negotiate with sort of a dozen different Western powers, and then the East is more and more fragmented. So I was very sympathetic to him, and it sounds like you're more sympathetic to him than I was ultimately. I kind of came down on the pick a campaign to win, because I mean, it,
yeah,
you know, to take that example, the Italy campaign is done on a small scale, relatively speaking. The army he sends is not likely to fight a pitched battle with the Normans and win. It's mainly there to capture towns and hold them. And then I was thinking earlier, you know, it felt, you know, again, I feel very judgmental sitting so distant from these decisions, but it felt a bit like with the Myriokephalon campaign, that he did the opposite, that he had such a large army that he thought, I can't divert the army from this course, so ends up blundering into this trap because it'll be too much of a nightmare to reroute this army around and so on. I mean, did you think my criticism was terribly unfair, or is there...
No. The pick a campaign to win thing, absolutely, I agree with. You know, and I mean, there's continuity in so many of these things. I mean, particularly, I mean, you know, I mean, someone should write some sort of comparison, I think, between, you know, Belisarius and Manuel's campaign, you know, when it comes to, you know, shoestring budget, small forces doing quite a lot. You know, and, you know, when equally sort of, you know, Myriokephalon there, I mean, there's going to be some sort of interesting comparison of Manzikert and things to be made, I think. So when it comes to, and obviously a whole bunch of different circumstances, and that's a very broad generalization. But it's interesting seeing some of these continuities across. But yeah, it's I know, because you've got to think they've all had similar kind of, you know, say, childhoods and training. Again, something I bring up a little bit in the book, and, you know, so what do these people know? And yeah, they've gone through, I mean, they've got, you know, this wealth of classical history and everything else, and they've read all the same thing, I mean, arguably, that we have, possibly even more than we have. When it comes to, you know, what to do, what not to do, obviously the practical stuff as well on, you know, for, you know, what to actually you do on campaign. I mean, these people are pretty highly trained, and you've got all of your, you know, Romans of command structure of, you know, subalterns and things, which no other medieval army seems to really have. I mean, you get a little bit of sergeants and stuff coming in this period and things like the Norman armies, but generally not really. This idea of ranks and everything else is pretty still unique to the Romans. And with this kind of wealth, they've got, you know, they know, think, you know, small force theory and defense in depth, and, you know, how lots of these things are all things that they'll have studied from more or less when they could read. And yet these things do keep happening. And so, you know, you wonder a little bit. I mean, and this idea of, I suppose, the sort of chess master emperor sort of planning it all out in advance, I think is, you know, definitely overplayed. As you said, there's so many competing priorities the entire time. And therefore, you know, what is my final judgment on Manuel? This is one of those things I have kinder days towards him when I read certain passages. And that is, in particular, yes, I mean, a few decisions taken differently, And it seems that particularly Italy, I don't know about Egypt, but definitely Italy, likely would have worked out. There are still, some benefits anyway. You know, fighting a war in someone else's backyard is much better than doing it in your backyard. I mean, arguably lots of the issues of Alexius and previously is that all the wars are happening in his backyard. And this is ruinous for, you know, your economy and everything else. So as much as, okay, he didn't conquer Italy, at least he didn't have the big Norman raids and wars that Alexius suffered and indeed would be suffered post-Manuel, is that, you know, the war was in their backyard at least. Which definitely in my more generous moments, I think, well, this is absolutely, you know, even if it's sort of a bit of a glorious failure, it's not in your backyard at least, and therefore possibly worth doing. And yeah, again, there's a little bit, you know, interesting little things when it comes to both Hungarian and arguably Byzantine troops in the 1140s. There's an interesting, it sort of implies there might be, you know, Roman boots on the ground in Italy under Lofi. It's only one little reference, but implies, you know, this isn't the first time, you know, since Bari fell that there have been troops in that area. You know, they are keeping this in mind that, okay, one of these days, if we manage to get, you know, the stars all align on this, then yes, we're back. And equally, there seems to be at least, I mean, definitely until the 13th century, I mean, there's still plenty of Greek monasteries and, you know, a population there that are welcoming to them. I mean, Naples is still, the dukes there are still using Byzantine titles until Roger takes over. So, I mean, there is very much, you know, the home there. And equally, arguably in the Middle East, I mean, you still got the Melkites and things today. So this is not something that sort of disappears, this idea that, one of these days, maybe we might be Roman again. So I don't think that, you know, anything Manuel was doing here was massively, out of the realms of possibility. Was his reach exceeding his grasp and he was trying to do too many things at once? Yes, it seems so. But I suppose it is one of those sort of Red Queen effect things. This is from Alice in Wonderland. It's used in evolution quite a lot, whereby so this little exchange in Alice in Wonderland where they have this race or something, and basically they're both sprinting as fast as they can and they stay at the same tree. And sort of Alice says something along the lines of just like, oh, where I'm from, you know, we race and we get somewhere else. And she's replied, here you need to run really fast just to stand still. So this idea that, you know, by doing all of these things, he manages to more or less keep the empire where it is. And if he didn't run that fast and try this often, then it would go backwards. And so that is, I suppose, my other sort of more generous appropriation, is that by doing these things, you know, manages to keep them where they are. And the second, you know, and so saying, oh, no, he should have sat back or focused on one thing, well, then everything would have gone out of control.
Yeah. I know. And I know, obviously my business is narrative, so I get a bit too narratively neat or whatever at times. And I, when I put this to Anthony Kaldelis, he didn't go click, but I said to him, you know, I sort of think if in the film or TV version of Manuel, when the Second Crusade happens, he has a sort of vision of the Fourth Crusade happening. I mean, not literally, but as in the Normans launch this attack on the Greek coast while the Second Crusade is passing through. And so he sees, well, this is a massive danger. And so my issue with Manuel is he then arrests all the Venetians in the empire, you know, whatever, 30 years, 40 years later. And they're his insurance against another Norman attack. So that's now gone. And then you haven't got any treaty in place with the Normans that's really solid. And then obviously you can then say, well, then the Fourth Crusade happens, or then the sack of Thessaloniki happens, so on. And Anthony Kaldelis was like, well, you know, the Roman fleet was still there and they could have seen off the Normans. So it's not, what you're saying isn't a sort of, you know, massive mistake on Manuel's part. My only issue with that is that the Roman fleet has always been there and the Normans have attacked many times before. So they're not insurance against them having a successful attack. But again, am I being too narratively specific in that instance?
Yeah. So the fleet thing is one of the things I find fascinating. Actually, one of my first articles is on the fleet. I mean, I don't know if in the depths of the internet, you might be able to find it kind of thing. It's on sort of John and the fleet, which is why it doesn't come up as much. It does come up a little bit in the book, but not as much, because there is absolutely the narrative of, in particular, that sort of John and Manuel had the same sort of top civil servant, this guy sort of, John Putzes, kind of thing, who in Coniates basically blame Coniates hates this guy. I mean, literally talks about him, you know, sort of, everything, he insults his wife, he insults, you know, he really does not like this guy. And this, of course, is the main source on him. But particularly in Coniates basically has this thing that he, in all this finance minister, in order to sort of save money, takes the taxes from what had previously been the sort of localized defense fleets, your thematic fleets that have been operating for a while, and essentially decides, well, this is no longer going to be spent locally on local defense fleets, but it's going to be centralized, in the capital. And that the line from Coniates is that the second this happens, that basically the local defense fleets died, and that actually all of the money in the capital was misused anyway. And so this didn't actually lead to anything happening. And that's, you know, a fair line that, you know, turns up in a lot of scholarship and sort of modern stuff as well, that, okay, this is this fault, and therefore that led to the end of the fleet, and therefore 1204, because of that. There's a few problems with this. Naturally, things like invasions of Italy and invasions of Egypt are pretty strong naval things, which if you had no fleet already, make no sense whatsoever. And equally, under John and Manuel, you have, you know, the armies going back and forth the entire time, being well supplied. I mean, the logistics of this whole thing, you know, keeping everyone with enough water, with enough food. I mean, there's some good stuff in this the books by John Pryor on this, on how to actually logistically, you know, deal with this. And, you know, you really can't do this with no fleet. The other sort of argument, and I think Sir Peter Frankopan makes this, is that even though there is no Byzantine army with the First Crusade, I mean, how are they eating for a lot of it? And yeah, the argument has probably got to be the Byzantine fleet is resupplying them the entire time, even though there's no army with them. And so therefore, this idea that, you know, the fleet just suddenly disappears doesn't seem to be the case. In which case, you've got to think, okay, well, what's going on with this bit? And why would you suddenly go from these little localized defense fleets to trying to have a kind of centralized navy? And for John, it seems to work out fairly well. And it's probably, as I said, the rise of, you know, Venice and the Normans, is that having a bunch of kind of patrol vessels, and you're great for sort of, you know, anti-Arab raiding, great at anti-pirate, that kind of thing, but are not great when you have a large armed fleet coming at you, because this thing is going to smash. And when the Venetians are going around the Aegean in the 1120s, this is basically what happens, is there's this huge crusader Venetian fleet that can do what it likes in the Aegean, because there is no localized defense force that can stand up to them. So unsurprisingly, this initiative that comes under John obviously is to create, okay, we need our own little, you know, I say little, you know, big centralized navy that can stand up to one of these things. Then, I suppose, with, as I said, the various crises that go on from the end of Manuel's reign onwards, is it likely that the money from this centralized fleet started to be misappropriated and used in other things? Yes, probably, particularly by late Angeloi and everything else. So the idea that sort of it was all declining from John, or indeed earlier, I think is definitely too much, because, I mean, the fleet is very effective. And the other thing in particular, the sort of the riverine navies, I mean, there's a lot of ships being used up and down things like the Danube, down sort of the major rivers, sort of in Anatolia as well, which, you know, are, you know, slightly smaller boats, though, to be honest, you can fit a trireme up the Thames quite far. I did the measurements, actually. It's in the article I wrote. It's quite fun. Anyway, you can basically fit these things up quite far up the Thames, at least as far as Oxford. So, you know, this is pretty useful, actually, for logistics and everything else. And therefore, this, if there is a big decline of the fleet, it happens pretty late on in the 12th century. And that if for some reason they are going back to these small, plucky defense fleets to counter the pirates, which they are, then obviously this isn't enough to stand up to a big centralized navy such as the Normans and Venetians have. So yes, you're to going back to your original thing, I suppose, the vision of kind of the raids and everything else immediately means, right, if we need to take this on, we need to have a similar large fleet that can gather. And your local defense forces aren't enough. And if you don't make that transition quick enough, this isn't good enough. And you, obviously you can see this in modern navy. I mean, no modern navy has, you know, small little localized, independent fleet commands. Are you either massive, like the, you know, obviously the US sort of, you know, fleet in the Pacific, fleet in whatever it is, which are big enough to be a fleet on and of themselves, or you've got to go in a carrier group. These things have got to be big enough to actually do something. Otherwise, you know, your small little, I don't know, things like, you know, I mean, I did a bit of stuff for modern fleets as well on this, you know, small things for, you know, localized defense is all very well, but are not going to be able to stand up to a major actual naval invasion. So you know, read that article if you want all the information on that before we get bogged down.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, I suppose, Man of Wheels thinking, I've got it. I've got a Norman attack covered with what I've got now. He can't anticipate how everything's going to unfold after his death. Which obviously takes us into
every 10 years is the other thing. I mean, these things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that takes us into the post Man of Wheel period. Mm. You know, from my point of view, there is a lot of contingent things going on. Mm. With Andronicus being a disaster and then the Bulgarian uprising succeeding. But a lot of scholarship tends to say the Komnenian system was inherently going to collapse at some point because of the nature of personal rule and the old court honor system no longer encouraging successful provincial leaders to kind of rise up and serve at the center and what have you. How do you see that that those arguments in that period?
Yeah, so I mean, I remember listening to Sid Nathan on this, and obviously he's very good on this kind of stuff as well. And initially, anyway, obviously you've got a system where in the early Komnenian system, anyway, you have a lot of interplay between the capital and the provinces. I mean, you can see this in bishops, you can see this in lawyers, some judges, you can see this in provincial governors. And there's kind of essentially a continuous system whereby maybe you're a capital person, but then you get sent out to the provinces and then you come back and maybe you get sent out again. And you can track this in various letter collections, particularly if I know these sort of, Italicus, sort of Prodromos, lots of these as well. And obviously they all prefer the capital. I mean, lots of these, you know, say, oh, now I'm posted here. Oh, I missed the capital. So they all prefer that. But equally, there is this system that sort of basically sends them back out. And this, I suppose, is what the provinces get out of the capital quite a lot of the time. And equally, as someone in the provinces, you want to go to the capital because then you can keep going up these sorts of ladders. And so even though there isn't the old court honours system, there are a whole bunch of ladders to go up. Lots of particularly sort of churchmen sort of, you know, seem to flit between ecclesiastical positions and imperial positions, the entire time on sort of separate thing, you know, depending on which, you know, which gives you lots of options, really. And I ran the numbers, actually, because I mean, this is one of those questions that keeps coming up. And I've probably been looking at this stuff since I was an undergraduate. And so I ran the numbers on exactly how many Komnenians are there in major positions across all of these various things. They are still this is obviously a slightly fraught process just to sort of say, put that out there, in that we don't have exactly complete lists of governors. We don't have complete lists of judges or anything like that. And there's lots of, okay, great, we know who the governor of this place was in 1130. And then we've got no other mention of it for ages. And we don't know who the governor of this particular province was 10 years later. And equally, lots of them are all called things like, Constantine Dukas. Is this the same Constantine Dukas? Is this a son? Is this a cousin? Is this, you know, so bear in mind, running the figures on this is a bit fraught, but I did the best I could on this. And at least sort of under kind of Alexius John Manuel on this kind of thing, it's definitely the minority of provincial governorships. They do tend to be, I'm going to say, the sort of the good ones. I mean, they almost always have a Komnenos in charge of Cyprus, or a very kind of, you know, someone married in and everything else. So very close. Likewise, something like Dyrrachium, obviously your major sort of, you know, fortress town in the Balkans kind of thing over there, usually somebody, you know, at one point in sort of John's reign, they even sort of, they have somebody who isn't a Komnenos and they sort of say, okay, you're retiring now, and put one in. So, I mean, it does tend to be, I'm going to say, the sort of the important ones. They are making sure there is somebody who's very close in. But otherwise, I mean, there are a lot of people who aren't. I would say it gets a bit blurry as to, here is somebody who is a major presence locally. Okay, they're invited to the capital for a little bit, and then they're appointed back to be in charge of their place. And this is something that did not go on so much. So there is a little bit more, I was going to say, recognition and appointment of local powers. This, of course, has pretty massive implications for how things turn out, if you do want to be a little bit teleological about it, as if they've been recognizing local major power brokers as the major figures for a while, and they have less involvement in the capital, this kind of feedback loop has already started to break down. You can see this in particular, the areas that are less, obviously, kind of, this is your sort of difficulty with Caldellist nationalist stuff, but let's say less Romany Greeky, technical term there.
Yeah.
So, we're talking about sort of your Serb lands, your Armenian lands, these sorts of areas. You have more recognition of the locals. Obviously, this is, the locals prefer this, of course. Great, I get to be prince of Diocletia, or Rashka, or indeed, obviously, Cilicia, famously, sort of, I mean, Cilicia there. But obviously, this does have implications when it comes to the locals wanting to suddenly go their own way when actually they're getting nothing out of the capital anymore. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, at least for your sort of Alexius, John, Manuel sort of area. Once we get a little bit later into, and I think this is more or less the short version of arguments, I think this is something that comes up during the Angeloi, you suddenly have obviously a lot, much less interplay. And that goes again across the board, judges, bishops, imperial figures. If you want to be in the capital, you stay in the capital. And equally, you get these sort of more homegrown bishops looking after local concerns. I mean, also things like justice. This is where you have bishops suddenly starting to be judges. This comes up in sort of, Eustathius and Thessaloniki and this kind of stuff as well. And suddenly, okay, the bishop's the main guy because we're getting less support from the capital than we used to. And I think this is combined with the fact that in your earlier Comnenian periods, sort of Alexius John and into Manuel as well, they have been, they have had in some ways a pro-province policy, particularly on the borders. This is, I suppose, the central kind of contradiction, is that these areas that were overrun with Turks, Normans, Pechenegs, Cumans, whoever, under Alexius, suddenly are kind of vibrant, very inverted commas, Greek Orthodox, Greeky Romany successor states in the 13th century. And this is because obviously you've got, all of these fortresses being built. You do have provincial governors being sent out. You have kind of the restoration of monasteries, the restoration of all of these things in things like Western Anatolia going on. And therefore, Nicaea is storming the sort of later principality there. All of these areas suddenly, and equally same with Serbia, same with Bulgaria, these areas that were these sort of border areas obviously do get a fair bit of support, investment of cash and fortifications, investment of decent personnel, who then get told to stay there. And then unsurprisingly, they think, okay, if we're staying here, we better make a good job of it staying here. And therefore, the second the capital is a bit weak, actually, they can go their own way. So in some ways, really positive Comnenian policies both laid laid down the groundwork for, as I said, vibrant successor states in these areas, is, I suppose, the central contradiction here.
It's very interesting. I mean, that's another fun part of your book, is showing the work John did rebuilding defenses in Western Anatolia. And most listeners will know that that's obviously where the Roman successor state comes from that retakes Constantinople, but they may be less familiar. We talked about it with Nathan Webdell, with Nathan, from Epirus, the west of Greece, another Roman successor state emerges, which is very successful for a good period. Hmm. So do you see the collapse of the, that sort of 1180 to 1204 period as largely contingent on factors that happened, or was it the Angeloi sort of lurching from one crisis to another that led provincials to go, well, why don't I just hang back and wait for this to settle down and I'll run things, down here?
Yes, I think it's, so having had, let's call it most of 80 years, to be honest, between Alexius and, later Alexius and Manuel, of provinces, and you can see this in the archaeology and everything else, provinces are materially much richer, particularly the border ones, because I mean that's where you want to put these things to, you know, safeguard these areas, and therefore, you know, Epirus, you know, some Dyrrhachian I mentioned earlier, these sorts of areas are, you know, much better than they were in the sort of, you know, inverted commas sort of peak empire under, you know, Basil II and similar. I mean, you know, your simple things like, I don't know, the pottery that, you know, is that we find, everything like that is much better in this period. You know, everywhere is doing much better, is, you know, person for person, you know, richer, it seems, than most of the sort of economic histories of Byzantium. Because of these sorts of policies. And some of it obviously is a fair bit of, you know, it's expansive, you know, wars in other people's backyards rather than yours, this kind of stuff, for a while. And then suddenly, you know, being in a better place by sort of around 1180, suddenly you have this moment then where everything is much more difficult at the center. And you feel like, oh, okay, actually, we're doing pretty well for ourselves here. In some ways, you know, the successful Comnenian policies really have left us better off. And then suddenly, you know, it's not, you know, the next wave is not continuing these. I mean, had, as I said, you had, I don't know, you know, this is the kind of, you know, had sort of, you know, Italy worked out, had a few more things, you know, over in Syria, etc., worked out, then in some ways, you know, the investments and everything else would have moved on to the next set of frontiers, and you would have started developing those even more. And equally, rather than there being a materially rich area that also has all the troops, actually the troops will have moved on to the slightly more difficult borderland area. This is one of those sort of things throughout history, is that, you know, you tend to have new dynasties coming from previous borderlands, because that's where the troops are. I mean, the Tudors in England is a good example as well. I mean, they're the Welsh border people who had the troops, just, you know, very similarly. So unsurprisingly, these areas, oddly enough, kind of that have the troops and the wealth suddenly in them. And that's Armenia, that's Bulgaria, that's Epirus, and that's, yeah, Western Anatolia, you know, sort of that's Nicaea and Trebizond. All of these areas have the troops and some wealth, which at that point, if, yeah, the center's not giving anything to them, if anything, the center is an active drain on them at these sort of things. Therefore, you know, why not go their own way for what seems like something that's, because I mean, previously, you know, you always, you know, as a successful general who defended your province and, you know, things are going badly at the center, you marched on the capital, you named yourself emperor, and, you know, the empire continues. And in some ways, I mean, had there been, I don't know, the Bulgarian rebellion been incredibly successful and they'd done that, you would have just ended up with a sort of Asin dynasty of emperors. That arguably is something that, you know, had they been a little bit more successful, they could have done. But, you know, it didn't. And likewise, as you said, Epirus and Nicaea does do that eventually. So in some ways, this is where wealth and resources, when it comes to troops, when it comes to, you know, material wealth, has been much more evenly distributed, meaning there isn't just one or two areas. I mean, this is actually back to your original comment, where suddenly there's a lot more players. You know, if you're dealing with not only all of these Western powers and all of these multiple Eastern powers, then you need to put troops and wealth in different places. And then suddenly everywhere's equal, and there isn't just a, you know, here is, you know, the challenger place and the capital that traditionally has everything. And then either the capital holds out and, you know, crushes the other one, or the new one crosses the capital and, you know, retakes it. Actually, suddenly, where there's multiple places around there that can all fight each other as well, of course, then this is why it ends up the way. And this is my sort of like big picture dynamics thing on this, is that in some ways, therefore, the spreading of wealth, and some of this is due to all of those other powers. I mean, your Venetians, your Genoese, Normans, equally everything else, is that, you know, Epirus, for example, I mean, that is supported by all of your, you know, well, what is today kind of your sort of, you know, Montenegro, that sort of area, you know, your lovely tourists sort of Dubrovnik and all of this kind of areas are in your kind of Byzantine trade area, which the second things are breaking down, it's still in Epirus's area. I mean, so John gets kind of all of these places to acclaim him as emperor at Easter, which is a small victory in some ways, but that plus trade rights is exactly what they want. So, I mean, this sort of developing world, and whereas, I mean, in your past centuries, you had, you know, Byzantium and, you know, obviously, sure, there's Persia or there's, you know, your other sort of major players. But that's about it. I mean, there aren't multiple smaller places all needing resources and all developing each other. And that, I think, is the change dynamic here in many ways, is that people have options. I mean, same for, you know, I know, say, I mean, look at Hungary, for example, which, you know, they're sort of getting Byzantine crowns and papal blessings at the same time. Serbia, you know, the Serbs do the same thing. You know, people have options the entire time. And this obviously makes it much more difficult to operate in. And so, yeah, that's why I said overall dynamic things. Could, therefore, you know, a slightly more, you know, a few battles differently one way or the other have kept it together? Certainly. I mean, you know, we could have ended up with an Assan dynasty, as we said, could have ended up with, you know, Epirus basically retaking Constantinople very soon afterwards. But, you know, why didn't it? In some ways, because I think of the successful Comnenian policies of resources and troops being everywhere rather than concentrated is my, I suppose, all purpose analysis of it.
It's really interesting because it's one of those things that, you know, a kind of map narrative sort of dominates the internet. So if the territory is decreasing, the whole empire must be weaker. Nice. Whereas there's been a lot of work on this, that the economy is actually growing, the population is growing. And as you're saying, it's hard to elaborate in a narrative why a political system collapses at the same time that people are actually better off. I mean, I tried to touch on this with the border in Western Anatolia, where some towns were growing because now the Turks are a new market to sell your produce to, where before that market wasn't there because the people over the hill are Romans growing their own stuff, or, you know, what have you. Just little dynamics like that. I mean, it's very interesting. And obviously, I'll be getting into the narrative of all these successor states relatively soon. So let's finish with 1204 then, which, you know, I thought I was amusingly harsh on the Crusaders and all their hypocrisy until I read Anthony Koldelis's New History, where he's absolutely scathing on another level about the kind of anti-Roman racist, we would say now, sort of rhetoric and ideas that and so on. I mean, what's your feeling about the Fourth Crusade? I mean, again, it's a topic we could talk about for ages. Is it a completely contingent event? Is it something that would have happened anyway? Did the Latins have their eyes on this prize one way or another? What's your sense of the Fourth Crusade?
So I'm going to preface my answer by saying that, funnily enough, so my next book, which I won't even start really writing for another year or so, is possibly going to be on this. And so I entirely retain the right to change my mind completely by the time I write something else down.
Of course.
But yeah, this is something I'll be probably putting together in about 2 years' time. So we'll see what happens, admittedly. But one of the things I'm already sort of starting to plot down a few ideas here. So one of the things I think I'm going to be highlighting a little bit is there is the very much the trope, and this includes in Byzantine literature and definitely also today, as you said, in interesting corners of the internet and things, of kind of, you know, Constantinople as, you know, the great, you know, classical unsacked city of antiquity that has, you know, survived everything and everything and everything until 1204. And in more recent history to 1204, this is not really true anymore. And, you know, just this is the kind of, you know, the nature of the city itself. And I'm saying it's not really true on both of those characteristics. I mean, I said there basically the great unsacked city of antiquity. On the one hand, you actually do have lots of pretty violent changeovers going on. This you can say, I mean, in recent times. So obviously Alexius famously comes in with troops. A little bit of sacking goes on that they try and brush under the carpet, and Anna definitely does, as much as possible. And, you know, he at the end of the day is taking over. Even John, you know, obviously, you know, his troops do take the gate, you know, the doors of the great palace off its hinges in order to get in. You know, this isn't quite, you know, it doesn't mention anybody dying or anything else, but then, you know, laudatory histories wouldn't. Equally, you know, you've got, and then obviously the second you hit the Angeloi, this is happening the whole damn time. And then, of course, once you do get to the sort of fateful events of the Fourth Crusade, suddenly, I mean, you've got a whole bunch of, you know, this rapid turnover of emperors, all of which are pretty military. And so the idea that sort of suddenly 1204 happens, and this is, the, you know, the great city sacked at last, is not really true, because I mean, actually, the city had been having a lot of little ones for a while at this point. So, I mean, that's kind of the one point. The other thing...
Shall I just jump in there? Sorry, just to remind... Listeners might be thinking, wait a minute, what? So we're talking about, let's say, Vranus's rebellion, which Isaac Angelos puts down with the help of... Now, there's brothers. Is this Conrad at that point? I'm forgetting.
Yes. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Of Montferrat. And the Latin troops are sort of allowed to sack the suburbs and then start looting people's houses, to sort of, because they're not being paid in any other way to celebrate such a victory.
Yep.
And then Andronicus lets people sack the Italian city quarters when he takes power. Are there any other ones I'm forgetting?
Those are the main ones. I mean, equally, I mean, with all of the various fires that go on and everything else, I mean, there's...
Well, and I suppose the palace gets looted, doesn't it, repeatedly? Yep. When Isaac takes control and then John the Fat's coup, so people are just running through the palace, stealing money all the time.
I mean, this is the idea of, you know, just think of it in, I don't know, modern terms, kind of thing. The idea of, like, there are multiple years in a row or, you know, small little gaps before that where you have, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, think of the, I mean, without meaning to make too many contemporary parallels, you know, obviously the outroar, the complete sort of uproar at sort of obviously the US Capitol thing. I mean, imagine things like that, but much, much worse happening for years.
Yes. You know?
And sure, you know, the government sort of continues and everything else. But I mean, this happening again and again and again.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I never talk about modern politics. And of course, nothing really happened on that day to affect the political. But if it happens six times in a row, someone will go, you know, this doesn't look great, does it? Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, as I said, much worse. And, you know, so I do my best not to have too many of these sorts of things. But yeah, obviously, that I think is an obvious sort of parallel on this kind of, you know, the seat of your government, this happening. And so firstly that, and equally the other aspect is that, you know, the great, you know, antique, you know, city of the Romans, and particularly in the 12th century, this is also not quite the case so much anymore. I mean, obviously we talked here, so there's the large Italian quarter, equally there's multiple, I mean, really we should talk about, you know, the Genoese quarter and the Pisan quarter and the Venetian quarter, all of which have their own little churches, their own monasteries. Equally, I mean, you've got, I mean, there's a good few lists in quite a few of the scholarship of things like, and here's the German church, and here's, you know, so all of these various groups, not to mention, I mean, you know, there's a mosque, you know, there's two competing rival Jewish communities, which are, you know, going from strength to strength in this period. You know, this is really quite a sort of, you know, global, you know, city. There's an absolute, you know, equally there's this, you know, sort of area which seems to be full of, Nubians, Ethiopians, you know, sort of sub-Saharan Africans as well, which the Crusaders are completely like, wow, at this, you know, sort of in this just like, oh, who are these people kind of thing, where it seems to have been, you know, perfectly normal in Constantinople before that, for these guys to be around. And so this idea of Constantinople itself being this kind of, I don't know, ethnic Roman, you know, sort of capital city is definitely not the case. In some ways, I mean, this is the source of its wealth at this point. I mean, this is great stuff in, so John Tzetzes, who's one of these sort of, you know, sort of poets and, you know, writers and everything else. He has this long thing, it might finally be translated one of these days, called the Kiliades, which is sort of, yeah, the sort of the, which he talks in this about how he goes up the street and he hears kind of this language, that language, next language, and he obviously is showing off a bit because obviously he can speak them all, you know. But, you know, this is very much kind of, you know, something much more similar to, inverted commas, a modern city when it comes to all of these different groups. And in some ways, I think this leads, I suppose, going back to some of the original stuff you asked there, to various people thinking that, okay, well, this is our city too, unsurprisingly. You know, there would have been generations of Venetians, you know, over 100 years worth of Venetians at least, who would have lived and died. Literally, you know, their great grandparents would have been, you know, born and, you know, worked in Constantinople, and they keep in touch with the people back home. And then suddenly, obviously, being, you know, this stuff in the 1180s and onwards. Indeed, you know, the quick few things before, but generally, I mean, would have been a big change. Something, well, this is our city just as much as anyone else's. And so I think that's kind of one of those other things that I'm going to be probably sort of picking up, is the changing nature of Constantinople in the 12th century in particular, meant that in some ways people felt like they definitely did deserve a piece of it. not to mention, obviously, you've got all of these kind of, as I said, you know, yeah, columnists obviously wanting them there. I mean, there you are, you live in this particular neighborhood and your various friends are Venetians, Genoese, Germans, whatever. Unsurprisingly, and you think, okay, and they're going to come in, they're finally going to sort out this political situation. Fair enough. These are my neighbors. There wasn't exactly total resistance in that sort of, I don't know, racist ethnic way either. There's plenty of, you know, Greeks who did work for the Latin Empire afterwards on this level. So, I mean, that's kind of these two sort of facets I'm going to bring up, is the fact that it, you know, seems to have been sacked on a small level multiple times, increasingly over the previous 100 years. And also the city itself had become, as I said, this, you know, really different global city in a way that I don't think really occurs again for, you know, until the modern period, to be honest. So, I mean, those are my sort of two kind of like slightly different threads I'm planning on bringing in myself on that, if that sort of semi gives you an idea of where my thinking's at.
No, that's really interesting. And I think that is one of those things when you read the sources and you realize the Crusader army isn't that big, and you think, well, why isn't the population of this huge city like they would have been in 717 working as one to throw them out? And you think, well, if they are much more disunited and politically disunited as they've become through all these factions and so on, it's easier to understand how this thing sort of happens without people realizing we're about to be sacked. This is a kind of, as you're saying, this is a high level political thing. Maybe the Crusaders will take over the city and install their own new government. You're not anticipating they're going to come to your house and steal all your stuff.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, well, I'll stick with my neighborhood. We'll be all right. We're not, you know, we're not in conflict with them.
Well, especially you've had Latin empresses for, you know, most of the last century. Therefore, at least half, if not more than half, Latin, you know, emperors, whatever it is. I mean, this is not to mention, so many, you know, various kind of, you know, your key positions, your provincial governorships, whatever it is. I mean, the idea of there being various, inverted commas, you know, alien Latins in charge is definitely not the case. They are completely normal part of the fabric of this thing. Just as kind of, you know, Christian Turks had been and all this sort of stuff as well. The written down sources, particularly after the fact, really have to justify this is why, well, to be honest, all these terrible things happened and this is why we were justified. And that's when the kind of the racial angle really comes in, is justifying this particularly to the rest of Christian Europe, is that, you know, these people deserved it because. Whereas how does it happen as it goes along? I think a lot of this is, as I said, because, you know, some of this has been building for quite a while. And in a way that didn't necessarily have to end up like this. I mean, could there have been some sort of, as I said, Latin empire without the sack? Yes. Which is another sort of thing that is not mentioned very much.
No, it's so fascinating. I mean, it's a good case study for budding historians, the sack, because it, within about a decade, it's everybody's interest to imply it was a horrible thing and it was everybody else's fault and it was terrible, and including the Latins. So it's really interesting for those. So then if you read all that, you go, oh, it must have been awful. And you need then to reconstruct things and work out, well, maybe it wasn't quite as bad as they're all saying it is. But anyway.
Well, I think the sack itself probably was, but the nature of the politics around it, you know, with sort of, I don't know, these evil people or that evil people, probably not. Agree.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it sounds like we might need to talk to you again in the future to gain more insight into that. So I think we'll probably wrap things up there and remind people that Emperor John II Komnenos, Rebuilding New Rome, 1118 to 1143, is available now from Oxford University Press. And go to the website to get a discount code. And Dr. Lau, thank you so much for coming back to talk to us, and best of luck with your next areas of study.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. And best to all of you out there as well.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.